its way of saying, you know, there's wonderful things about Athens, but look, there's this too. He was subject, Thucydides was, to many of the influences of his time. Like Herodotus, for example, he was very much influenced by the dramatists. There is a very powerful dramatic element in Thucydides in the way he structures his account. But there is also much in Thucydides that is dramatic, for instance, in his use of deliberately archaic language. How often do we see writers use archaic language to add a sort of a element of a hint of authenticity, you see, to what they write? The medical writers taught him a great deal. This is the time of Hippocrates, the first of the great medical writers. They taught him about analysis, about etiology, progress, and diagnosis. There is something profoundly medical about the way Thucydides examines the Athenian body politic. The Sophists, and we'll hear much more about the Sophists in our very next lecture when we turn to Greek philosophy, they taught him about the power of rhetoric, the power of language to influence people, the power of language to prevail, the power of language to trump absolute truth, to trump justice. The Melian Dialogue is his famous example of this. The island of Melos lays off the coast of the Peloponnesus, had always been independent, utterly neutral, the Switzerland of Greece. The Athenians went to the Melos and said, you must join our empire. The Melians said, thank you very much, we've always been neutral, we're not going to join your empire. The Athenians said, well, actually you are, or else we'll kill you all, and enslave the ones we don't kill. The Melians said, that's unjust. The Athenians said, justice has nothing to do with it. We have the power to make you do this. And since we have the power, we have the right to use it. The Melian says, where's the justice in that? And the Athenians say, might makes right. There's no good evidence that Thucydides believed that at all. But he knew that that was one of the great currents in the Athens of his day. And he laid it out that way for people to see it. Now, there were other historical writers later in the Greek world, Xenophon, for example, a prolific writer. He continued Thucydides' history of the Peloponnesian War. He wrote a history of Greece in the latter part of the, in the first part of the 4th century BC. He wrote a book, sort of a how-to manual for a Persian king. He wrote an account of a Greek mercenary army in Persia. Some have said Xenophon was more almost journalist than historian. He was not the literary artist that Herodotus or Thucydides were. And he didn't have the same elevated sense of fundamental principles and fundamental ideals. But he carried on and extended the Greek historical tradition. And so what we can see in the best of these Greek historians is people engaged with the world of their day, engaged with the art forms of their day, engaged with the great intellectual issues of their day, speaking to their contemporaries, yes, and speaking to the future as well, to us. One final context, then, that we must sketch is that of Greek philosophy. And we'll turn to that in our next two lectures.
Lecture 12, From Greek Religion to Socratic Philosophy.
Hello again, and welcome to the 12th of our lectures in this series on the foundations of Western civilization. We've been talking about the public cultures of the polis, and today we turn to one of the most durable of all the Greek inventions, of all the inventions of that remarkable institution, the polis. And this is philosophy, the love of wisdom. The philosopher is one who loves wisdom. Now, the Greeks invented philosophy as a formal intellectual discipline with its own rules, with its own system, with its own way of asking questions and of answering questions. This is a process that began to emerge, as we'll see, about 600 BC over in Ionia. It has persisted until this morning. It has not stopped. Now, we ought to clear up one or two possible misconceptions. If I say the Greeks invented philosophy, do I mean to imply by that no one before the Greeks had thought seriously about anything? Do I mean to say that people before the Greeks had not amassed large amounts of information? No, of course not. That would be absurd. There is a difference between what the Greeks themselves had done in early times and continued to do, and what other people did, and philosophy. That's the crucial point. Now, generally speaking, before the Greeks, amongst other peoples, in other words, and even among the early Greeks, philosophy, what we would think of later as philosophical explanations, worked at the level of religion and worked at the level of what we would call cosmological explanations. Cosmos means, in a sense, everything, the ordering and arrangement of everything. Cosmology is the study of the origins and arrangement of everything. A poet, slightly younger than Homer, for example, whose name was Hesiod, wrote a book called The Theogony, in which he attempted to explain how everything got here. And this was attributed to wars and battles and contests among generations of the gods and goddesses way back at the mists of time. Now, there's a very interesting comparison we could draw, for instance, with the first 11 books, the first 11 chapters of the book of Genesis, where we also have a very detailed account of creation. But not there because of quarrels among the gods, but because a god had a particular purpose in mind and arranged things for a reason, arranged things, as it were, with meaning. So the Greeks